I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'll be your Inspector Morse of images, but without the beer and the Jaguar, sadly. Every week I will be taking a new image and scrutinising it, pulling it apart and finding out what historical information it reveals. I'm an Oxford lecturer, broadcaster and writer, but most importantly, I am a lover of all things art historical. I'm never happier than when I'm up close and personal with an image. Today I am joined by award-winning broadcaster and writer, Bettany Hughes, who has just emerged from 10 years of research on her new book, Istanbul, A Tale of Three Cities, which sounds absolutely fascinating, Bettany.
Thank you. I have got a large coffee in front of me as we're having this conversation. So yeah, 10 years of research and writing, but it's a big old city with a big history, so it was worth the effort.
Oh, I can't wait to read it. I'm really excited. And we are going to be looking at one image in particular. What's brilliant about the wonderful team at History Hit is they have embedded the image into the podcast. So if you click on the link, you should be able to bring it up in high definition. You'll be able to see what we're talking about. We've got something very exciting today, haven't we? We have the mosaic of Empress Theodora from the Basilica of San Vitale in Ravenna. Now, it might not be one that jumps into your head as one of the great hits of art, but Bettany, there was a reason for picking this, yeah?
There was. I mean, she's got a connection to Istanbul, which of course was called Constantinople, but as you say, this is from Ravenna, not from Constantinople itself. I think this is one of the most important images in the story of art because this comes from, in a way, a time that man forgot. So we're talking about that period between around 300 AD and 1300 AD. And what we're looking at is this Empress Theodora standing resplendent in the centre of this mosaic. And she was one of the most powerful women in the world. She should be a household name. We should all know about her. She has the most extraordinary story. So that's why I thought it'd be worth having a chat about her.
Yeah, two powerful women talking about powerful women.
Exactly.
We're going to have some fun.
And we've got three dark women as well, because Theodora is famously dark. So there we are. There's obviously something subconscious going on.
We're like for like. Yeah, absolutely. Let's give a bit of background, though. So the Basilica of San Vitale is part of this amazing World Heritage Site in Ravenna, this wonderful area that time has forgotten almost, that used to be the capital of the Western Empire. And because of its later history, remains rather unchanged. It's like walking back in time being in Ravenna, isn't it? And the particular image comes from, as I said, the Basilica of San Vitale, which was finished in 547 AD. And this particular image is one of a pair. There's two that approach the apse of the basilica. And Theodora is on one side. Her husband, Emperor Justinian, is on the other. And the image measures about 8 foot 8 by 12 foot, and it's made of mosaic, isn't it?
It is. And as you say, that date is really critical because the church itself is started around 527, 526 AD, but it's not completed for 20 years. And there's a really critical reason for that. As you say, at the time, this is when Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean are in absolute turmoil. So the old Rome has fallen, the new Rome, the second Rome, Constantinople, has risen, and there's real churn in society. It's not clear who of the world powers is going to have the upper hand. And at this point, so in the 520s, you've actually got Ostrogoths in charge of large parts of Western Europe, what used to be old Roman territory. And the guys in Constantinople don't like this one bit. They don't like it because it means that they've got less lands to call their own, but they particularly don't like it because the Ostrogoths are Arian Christians. So they think of them as heretics, and they, you know, Constantinople is the centre of Christendom, and they want to reclaim these territories for the one true God to be worshipped in the way that they believe is the right way to worship the divine. So what's happened is that Justinian, as you said, who's on the other side of the church, staring at his lovely wife, Theodora, he's made it his mission really to kind of recapture the glory days of the Roman Empire. And so he's embarked on this series of campaigns. He's reconquered large amounts of actually both the East and bits of North Africa and Western Europe. And now, from 540 AD, he has got Ravenna. So what we're looking at in this gorgeous mosaic is Justinian the Emperor and his Empress Theodora really making their mark and proving to the world that they are back in charge.
And there's so much going on in terms of the politics, the religious climate, as you say. It's a very complicated time. We think of the Ostrogoths giving name to this Gothic, obviously misused, but the barbarian in a way. But it's all coming down to this judgment on how to look at the divine nature of Christ in particular, isn't it? So Arianism focusing on the humanity of Christ, help me out, Bethany.
Monophysitism.
Phytitism, that's it. Too many isms there. And that is saying that Christ is more divine than human. And it's about this delicate balance, isn't it, in the natures of Christ. And it might not seem like such a big deal, but this is a deal breaker as far as political allegiances go. And it's playing out in the 6th century. And then on top of this religious controversy, of course, you have the East and West empires and the idea that they used to be one. That's what Justinian wants again, isn't it? He wants to reclaim part of the Western Empire as his.
And really, he's completely right to do so. We look at this, I think, kind of from the wrong end of the telescope. So we look at it from a very Western perspective, to be honest. You know, that the Roman Empire, of course, it was based around Rome. But for centuries, particularly in its latter half, it was looking east. And that was its field of operations. And the new Rome, Constantinople, is an Eastern empire. So it's got land that stretches right the way over to the Caucasus, to Azerbaijan, down into what we'd think of as land typically owned by the Persians. So what Justinian is doing is in the 6th century, talking the middle of the 6th century, when this beautiful mosaic was created, and they're in charge of an empire that covers 1 million square miles. It is enormous. And then the energy and dynamism and verve with which it is run is also quite extraordinary because, as you say, there's lots of religious controversy. They are certain that they are right and that they are ruling the world on behalf of God. And I think we can see that in this beautiful mosaic. So Justinian has a halo around his head. Theodora, who we're looking at now, so his wonderful Empress Queen, has also got a halo around her head. That's not saying that she is divine, but it's saying that her role as empress has its origins in the divine. So she is no mere mortal. And the more that you unpick both the story of Theodora and the way that she's represented, you can see that they are being really delivered to the world. I'd argue, we might argue about this a bit later, I don't know, but I would argue it's almost as if Justinian is Christ himself, is the kind of the judge in the court of heaven, and Theodora is his mother, the Virgin Mary.
Mary
Theotokos, as she's been described by now, as Mary, the mother, the bearer of God. So this is a Mary who really matters.
Absolutely. That's it. It's all about the divinity of rulership here on earth, isn't it? These are Christ's representatives on earth. And the whole scheme of the Basilica at San Vitale, it's an amazing building because, for a start, it's called a basilica. But basilicas are usually long, rectangular church buildings. This is octagonal. And it's all about, it's actually trying out a whole load of architectural devices that will later be really brought to fruition in Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. But this is sort of a practice run, if you like. But the focus of all the decoration is this apse. And in the apse is an image of Christ, very youthful. The rivers of paradise flowing out from his feet. He is haloed. And there is a sense in which the figures here, these secular rulers, these imperial figures, they are on a similar level with Christ. They're not much smaller than him. The proportions are that Empress, Emperor and Christ are all part of one collective divine presence, aren't they?
And they're also wearing the same clothes. Oh. So there's Christ in purple silk, and Theodora in front of us has this gorgeous, obviously represented in mosaic form, gorgeous purple silk gown draped around her. I mean, she is such a luscious creature. She's bedecked with these beautiful jewels, this wonderful crown, these kind of ocean fat uncut gems. If you ever see the gems and the jewellery from the Byzantine world, they're amazing, because we're used to stuff having all these facets, but actually they've got this kind of raw beauty to them. And just a tiny aside, the necklace that Theodora is wearing in this, you've probably noticed this, it's really funny, it often turns up in Anglo-Saxon England.
It's a Desborough necklace. Yes.
It is. Yeah. So it's like, it's the women of Anglo-Saxon England going, look, I've got one very light. There's this empress.
They're all wearing this on the catwalk in Constantinople.
I mean, totally, 100%. So she's a beautiful creature, Theodora, bedecked and bejeweled. There were very kind of strict sartorial rules at this time in the Byzantine court. So Justinian. Both Theodora and Justinian had very lowly origins, and so, as often happens, he wants to really distinguish himself and prove that, you know, he's upper class. And one of the things that he says is nobody else, they can't bedeck their bridal wear or their horses or their clothes with, with pearls and hyacinths and amethysts. And so, but what a lovely idea that that's what Justinian and Theodora are doing. And you can totally see that here, that she's really dripping with jewellery.
And the purple is so important, isn't it? Is this Tyrian purple? Stuff made from snails, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. That's a dye made from snails.
It is. I can tell you all about that, Nina, because I've recreated the production of purple dye from these mollusks, these sea snails, and it's the most disgusting process. This bit wasn't disgusting. I had to go and dive off the coast of Crete and get some of these snails. And then what they used to do is they used to sort of factory farm them, actually. They put huge numbers together so that the snails got stressed and they'd turn to cannibalism and they'd start to pierce one another's shells, and that caused a kind of chemical reaction. Then you basically sort of smelch it all in human urine, and the purple dye comes out. It's utterly gross, and you need something like 12,000 snails to make enough purple to dye the hem of a single garment. So you can imagine the scale of this thing, and why purple was therefore considered so rich and could only be the colour of empresses or emperors or of the divine. And that goes right back to the Bronze Age. So we know from these Linear B Greek tablets, I love it. It's called Wanax Purpura, which is, you know, the purple of the king. And that's a tradition that continues. And the Byzantines are very, 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 very keen on their purple. Yeah. So they have these purple silks, as Theodora is wearing in this mosaic. You see a bit more purple there with some of her attendants too. And they were mad keen on this purple marble called porphyry.
Yeah, I was going to say, empurpled manuscripts, porphyry marble, that's the sign of imperial power, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And you want to be buried in a porphyry tomb as well, which Theodora was.
Yeah, porphyry sarcophagus, exactly. Yeah. So the purple is very important. The colour is very important. She is, as you say, bedecked in these pearls. Pearls, of course, again, a symbol of purity in many ways and associated with the Virgin. But Theodora herself, not necessarily the purest pearl in the
No, I think we can very honestly say that. And I say this in all support and respect for Theodora. Our issue with Theodora is that we only have a couple of sources for her, and they are fruity, to put it mildly. So what we're told of Theodora is that she started out her life in Constantinople around the Hippodrome. She was the daughter of a prostitute and of a bear trainer and keeper, and that her trick was erotic gymnastic dancing, which she did in order to entertain people in between chariot races at the Hippodrome. It goes further. We're told that she wishes she had more than three orifices with which to pleasure the men around her. And she had all kinds of very saucy tricks, which actually I talked to Dan Snow about, so you have to listen to
that. He got to talk about the goose and the ribbon, did he?
He did. He went a bit quiet when we were talking about that.
the idea that the geese are pecking the bits of grain off Theodora's naked body, essentially.
Well, yes, but it's all very tasteful, because actually what she's doing is she's reenacting the story of Leda and the swan. So when the queen of Sparta, Leda, is taken by Zeus in the form of a swan, and this is what Theodora reenacted.
Anyway, I'm so glad you said that, because I've read that section from Procopius's Secret History before and just thought, what is going on? But of course it's Leda and the swan. That makes perfect sense. I was thinking of Emma Hamilton and her the mimes that she used to do.
Yes.
But she's called a dancer, a mime artist. It's not just about the fact that she may well be a courtesan or a prostitute.
No.
She is performing, and she's becoming very famous. By the time she's 15, she's one of the most famous performers in the Hippodrome, isn't she?
She is. So she's a very famous performer. She goes basically on a sort of tour of Byzantine territories and North Africa. I mean, I'm sure she slept her way to the top, but fair play to her. You know, how else do you survive in this? And it's such a tough world. And she's very clever. She's clearly really, really, really clever, Theodora. And she becomes a spy as well. So she sleeps with men for their secrets. She manages to kind of work her way back to Constantinople, converting to Christianity.
Yes, she becomes a hermit for a while, doesn't she? Or at least she subscribes to this hermit tradition that's taking place in Northern Africa at this stage.
Yeah, so she hooks up with a group of Christians in Alexandria. So and they're quite radical Christians. So it sort of seems as though that's partly where her faith comes from. It might also come from the fact that Christianity is a faith of social justice, and she's aware of that. You know, there are very interesting messages in it for her. And it's entirely relevant, because once she's come back to Constantinople, whether it's through her power as a spy or her sexual prowess, we don't know, she catches the eye of Justinian, the emperor, the most powerful man in the world, and he changes the laws of his empire so that
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
He can marry an actress, and she comes into the palace, and then she is his partner. I think they were in love with each other. I mean, people talk about how they were a partner in business, in strategy, in politics, and how embarrassing it was because they kept on kissing each other the whole time. But I think they were an extraordinary pair. But what she does, why I love her, I'm so happy that we're talking about this beautiful mosaic, which is just beautiful in and of itself, but because of what it tells us, is that, isn't this incredible? So we're talking about the middle of the 6th century AD, and pretty much as soon as she's in power, it looks like she tries to enact social justice, and she changes laws in all kinds of ways. So between them, they say that men can't get into debt without asking the permission of their wives twice, which is brilliant. She increases the penalties for rape. She makes it harder to rape and then go away without being taken to trial. She sets up a safe house for prostitutes just across the water, the Bosphorus, in the city. I mean, what an incredible thing to do.
I think it's so interesting. I'm sure you feel like this too, Bethany, but we always tend to look historically as that we are somehow the zenith, that we are standing on the shoulders of all the giants that have gone before. But in fact, you can look back to this period, but all through history, and find these moments of liberal change, of enlightenment. This is an enlightened partnership because there are no other rights for women up until this point. And yet Justinian is so responsible, isn't he, for rewriting civil law to the point that it's still in place in some parts.
It is. It's the basis, really, of a lot of our European law. So, no, they are fundamentally important.
And there she is, putting women into the picture, writing them in physically into the art historical record too, because what is so notable about these two facing mosaics is that actually of the two, Theodora's is the more luxurious, the more bejeweled, the more beautiful and shockingly lavish and wealthy of the two.
And she's surrounded by these female companions, and we know that she probably had a retinue of around 4,000. A lot of those were women, a lot were eunuchs as well. So these were all women who mattered in the world. I mean, I think just kind of to have as a little kind of sidebar, we shouldn't look at it with rose-tinted spectacles as well. She also murdered people, tortured people, you know, imprisoned them without trial, all of this.
Rather Game of Thrones at times. It
incredibly so. And Justinian's law code is kind of great. For some people, it's terrible if you're gay, if you're Jewish, you know, if you're any kind of a heretic. So, you know, they aren't just sort of sitting in Islington kind of being
high-minded.
Reading Guardian and being high-minded. No, absolutely not. But you're right that she brings women back into the story, and we hear these great, great tales of her. We're looking at these wonderful, her train of women around her now, kind of clustering together, looking, I don't know whether I'm being fanciful, but just looking to me self-confident, you know, as if they're sure of themselves in the world. Also, as you say, draped in these beautiful cloths, but of course, Constantinople was the end of the Silk Roads, so there were all these incredible materials that they had access to. And she goes off with them, for instance, they go on these sort of bathing trips to the hot baths across the Sea of Marmara, at a place that's now called Yalova, and then up to what place that's now called Bursa. And her baths, Theodora's baths, still exist. There is a terrible irony. I went there to try to sit in the bath and sort of commune with the spirit of Theodora. And it's men only in the bit that her bath is. I mean, there is a section for women, and I think actually it's nothing. This isn't being repressive. They actually gave the sort of nicer, slightly latent Ottoman bit to women. But I found myself slightly weirdly hovering around the edge of these baths, trying to peer in, sort of reassuring the men that I wasn't, you know, there.
I'm a historian.
All I'm interested in, chaps. Believe you me. Anyway, this is what Theodora did. So she used to go on these kind of great trains and, you know, have a lovely time in
Bath. She's clearly in motion here as well. I mean, we should say some details of what we can see in front of us as well, because there's a procession of women. This is an outdoors scene, I think, which is quite interesting, because if you compare it with the one opposite of Justinian and his entourage, they're clearly inside the church. They're against this gold background. Whereas we've got the sense that these women are processing into the church. They're going to go behind this curtain, past the fountain where they would wash themselves, and then take part in this eternal procession. And she is carrying the chalice. Justinian carries the paten that would have had the Eucharistic host. She has the chalice that would have contained the wine. And what this means, because of course the real irony of all of this is that they never went to Ravenna. They would never have seen these images, and they never physically set foot in this church. But by putting them into the walls of the building, they have become part of an eternal procession, haven't they?
They have. And it's beautiful. It's so dramatically rendered, as you say, that there's somebody just kind of two to the left of her who's holding back the curtain, and there's this intriguing dark space that it looks like she's going to enter with that chalice. So it's a kind of brilliant narrative work, this. Very dynamic, as you said, but it is physically setting her in stone, in the stone, in Ravenna, and proving that she has power there. And all those, as well as the imperial connections, exactly as you said, all the sacred connections, the fact that she's cradling this beautiful gold chalice in her hands tells us that she is connected to the divine through her role as sacred empress.
And there's so much we can learn in this about the fashions, about the material culture of the 6th century, because, you know, that chalice, it's it's got those beautiful cabochons on it, hasn't it? Those big fat gems on it. And as you said, you know, there's these parallels with jewellery that's found outside of Constantinople. This was cutting edge. This was how women wanted to dress. And she's got the imperial purple, but rather interestingly, on the hem, of course, there's the three magi picked out in this sort of gold thread. But again, this idea that she's bringing a gift. She is being cast in a sort of biblical guise. This is that weird sense of time being elastic. It's both a living person and someone who is part of this sort of sacred narrative that explodes time. She's a part of that too.
Totally. So you're not just in two times at once, you're in many times at once when you look at this image. It's been much debated what those three magi are doing as the embroidery on the bottom of her beautiful purple silk. Are they, like her, taking a gift into the church? Is it just kind of mirroring that progress? Or, again, subtly, are they saying, the Magi brought their gifts to the Virgin Mary. This is the incarnation of the Virgin Mary, and this is, we're bringing our gifts to her. So I think there's something actually slightly subversive theologically going on
there.
But also,
I mean, that's the beauty I love about studying late antique art, medieval art. There's this idea of multivalence, the idea that multiple meanings can coexist, that those magi are mirroring the processions in here. But as you say, it's almost making Theodora into the Theotokos, the mother of God. Love that. Absolutely love that.
I've got a very controversial suggestion about it as well. Is that I also wonder if there's something even older and more pagan and prehistoric going on here, that we all know often people talk about the Virgin Mary sitting with the Christ child on her knee, and that perhaps this comes from the Egyptian images of the goddess Isis with Horus. I actually think there's something else. I think that's too easy. I think that if you look, there's an amazing sun goddess. And as you know, it's usually a sun god, but there's a sun goddess from Anatolia who's very, very powerful from around 1500 BC onwards. And she sits in these beautiful bronze figurines with a huge gold halo staring out exactly like this with a child on her knee. So I actually think this might be Theodora as a long distant descendant of the Anatolian sun goddess.
The halo, the fact that she's haloed, is intriguing too. This idea, there's some controversy over the dating of this, isn't there? Whether it was either before she died or after she died. And am I right in thinking that the shell shape above her could be a sign that she has just recently died, because this is a sort of martyr's sign?
I think that's right. And actually, if you look at her, although she's strong, she's also very thin and pale. And she died when she was only 48. And we think it was probably cancer, possibly breast cancer. And actually, that might tell us why she was so keen to go and sit in those hot baths so often, that she was trying to deal with the pain of cancer. So she looks to me, there is something slightly haunted about this image. So I wonder if it is actually a celebration of her after her death.
And what's interesting as well, I think Justinian didn't remarry, did he?
No.
And he didn't have any heirs.
No.
Because she didn't bear him any live children. And this idea that he saw himself as someone forging forward, building a new Roman Empire again. And yet, without her, he didn't simply replace her. He clung to her memory and had continued to commemorate her. And he actually poured his energies, didn't he, into building projects on a massive scale.
He did. And he still, there's something very touching that for the years after she'd died, he always diverted the processions to go and light candles by her tomb, which is just, you know, a kind of remarkable thing. But as you say, very significant, because the Empress was thought of as important a part of imperial control and that whole kind of statecraft as an emperor. So significant that he didn't take a new wife and take a new consort.
I mean, it does seem that in this mosaic, in this series of mosaics inside San Vitale, that by writing themselves in alongside Old Testament characters, New Testament images, symbols of the apocalypse and the end of days and Christ, they are part of this large spiritual narrative. But that their love is being also commemorated.
I think their love is being commemorated. I think there's no doubt about that. That they, both of them, Justinian came from humble origins as well. His uncle, who he inherited power from, was an illiterate swineherd for most of his life. So, you know, they, my goodness, this is the meek really shall inherit the earth in the form of these two. So I think it's celebrating their love. I think it's celebrating their slightly unorthodox approach to life. And we need to remember them because they reformed. And one of the great things that they did is that they welcomed refugees into the city of Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. And they got it right. They gave over their palace to refugees, and they used to have to kind of put these extra sheets and things up in the rooms as dividers because there were so many in there. So they are not saints, even though they are actually saints.
They are officially.
They were not saints in their lifetime, but they deserve our love and respect.
And just to say a last little word about how this image looks, because I think to people who might expect their art to come in the sort of watercolour landscape variety, this is a rather startling artwork because it is, of course, made of little tesserae. It is a mosaic, something that we would traditionally, I suppose, associate with floor decoration within the Roman Empire. But this up on the walls and using particularly lots and lots of gold. And stylistically, quite abstracted in a way, isn't it? They're not hyper-realistic. They're not shown with lots of delicate facial features. They've been almost transformed into these icons, do you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, and as you say, so there are mosaics on the walls. There would have been actually lots of paintings throughout the Byzantine world which haven't survived, but it's the mosaics that have survived. They're 2D because this is a time of Christianity where there's an anxiety about the graven image, which is why we don't have so many sculptures, but we have these flat sacred images. And yet they've managed to cheat a little bit because the gold, the tesserae are all put in at angles, so they would have reflected and bounced back. It would have been dancing with light from lanterns and candles and from the big windows in the church at this time. But it is, as you say, it is slightly odd. It's distinctly medieval. But that's one of the reasons that it was neglected, that people said, oh, this isn't proper. These aren't proper Romans because they aren't doing things in perfect, figurative, heroic nudes. It's all a bit strange and flat and therefore primitive. But then, my goodness, they are missing the trick.
Absolutely.
Because the Byzantines know that they can do that and they've gone beyond that and they're being much more experimental with their art.
You're so right. This is the thing that always frustrates me, that, oh, this is bad art. It's just not as good as how the classical artists did it. But of course, the meaning behind this sort of art isn't about representing the perfection of the human body. It's about the spiritual, the symbolic, the messages that this sort of art carries. It's about seeing these figures not necessarily just as human, but as part divine. And the divine cannot be shown simply as flesh and bones. So yeah, I mean, that's partly explains why there's all this glamour. I love what you said there about the tesserae. Of course, the interesting thing when these mosaics have been excavated and really looked at up close is the technical skill that's gone into making these, the different glazes that have made the different colours, because there's so many vibrant colours after, you know, 1,500 odd years. And then the angling that would almost make the figures look like they've come to life, like they are physically still processing in this eternal procession. So I think there's a lot to be said of it just purely from the technique basis. But she's an incredible figure. And I think if this mosaic hadn't survived, maybe we would not have the real sense of who she was in quite such a way. The image helps us to understand her, would you say?
Oh, it definitely, it draws us. It's as far as we know, it's the only surviving image that we have of her. So this is Theodora, and it speaks to me of her extraordinary life, her fight against all of the odds to end up the most powerful woman in the known world. But more than that, this speaks to me of the power, not just of the body, but of the mind and the spirit.
Wonderful. Oh, Bethany, I could talk to you all day, but it's been so lovely to talk to you about this mosaic. I was delighted when you suggested it, and it really does bring the history of Constantinople, of Istanbul, which your book will illuminate further, into focus. I will be back talking to you about more artworks as part of the Art Detective series. If you want to follow me, you can on Twitter. My handle is Dr. Yanine Ramirez. I'm on Facebook too. Thank you so much to the History Hit team, the big brains behind this project, and thank you once again, dear Bethany Hughes. This has been a pleasure.
Total pleasure for me. I'll be back.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.